Speak it into existence. That's what we used to say in the black church growing.
Expectations.
Speak it into existence.
Expectations. Just like inflation. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
And I'm Kimberly Adams here for Molly Wood. It's been a while since I've talked to you on this, Kai.
It has.
It is. But I'm excited to join on a Tuesday, which means it's the deep dive into a single topic, and it's a topic that I have just been obsessed with pretty much since the presidential election campaign, and it's about voting rights.
Yeah, and it's kind of tough to not be obsessed about this stuff. There are more than a handful of states, 14 of them, Georgia, Arizona, Florida, that have passed laws that restrict voting. We know Texas is working on it as well. Some of them make it harder to vote by mail. Others impose new or maybe stricter voter ID requirements, make it easier to remove voters from voting lists. There are all kinds of ways that this can be done, and it's all expensive. So there's money coming in all over the place. We're going to talk about all of that stuff.
Yeah, so we are going to talk about what's driving this new wave of voting laws and how it's kind of an extension of what's always been going on around voting in this country, who's bankrolling the effort and why. Yeah. So, yeah.
Daniel Wiener is the deputy director of the Brennan Center. That's a nonpartisan group which monitors and keeps track of, a lot of things in our civil society, but voting laws among them. Daniel, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me set the stage here, and I'm going to go real big picture first, and I'm going to point out and ask whether this is a new phenomenon, the restriction of voting rights in the United States.
I think that's a great question. I have to say that efforts to restrict who can vote have sadly been with us for a long time. I mean, obviously. When this country was new, voting rights were very heavily restricted. And I think, all of our history to some extent has been sort of this process of struggle about who gets to be included, officially in our democracy. Mm-hmm. I think that it is not new. It's obviously in a very different phase than it's right now. But this is a fight that in some sense has been with us since the founding era.
And so what's happening now, or what's been happening, particularly in the last year or so, that is bringing this all up, or at least into the public eye again?
Yeah, while we have been in this struggle for a long time, I do think that it's achieved really an unprecedented, at least in the last, 50 years, intensity in the past year. And some of that has to do with rhetoric from the top. Obviously, in 2020, the sort of big lie, as many of us say, about mm-hmm. voter fraud being widespread, mm-hmm. Achieved new prominence. And then I think there's just also been, a decades-long progression where the efforts to restrict who can vote and to basically keep eligible voters away from the ballot box had fallen out of favor, really, particularly, with passage of the Voting Rights Act in the late 1960s. But we have seen this process where those sorts of tactics have become again, unfortunately, kind of legitimized, at least in some quarters. And we see that sort of building intensity. And now it's kind of burst forth really in many respects, the most aggressive attempt to restrict voting that we've seen, unfortunately, since the Jim Crow era.
Do we know who's paying the bills for this? Because all of this kind of campaigning and all of the things that are going on, none of it's cheap.
We know some of who is paying the bills. We know, for example, that there are very prominent organizations like the Heritage Foundation, like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. We know where mm-hmm. some of their money comes from. But a lot of it is unfortunately hidden. So this has become an increasingly contentious issue. You may be aware, of course, that after the January 6th insurrection, a number of large companies vowed to sort of cut off funding for politicians who had supported that. But the money that, you know, it goes to elected leaders, which is the most disclosed, is only a relatively small portion of what's actually bankrolling this stuff. And while we know about some of it, a lot of it is unfortunately not subject to public disclosure.
Yeah. And when you say bankrolling this stuff, we're talking about efforts to help lawmakers who want to do voter suppression laws actually write the legislation, advertisements to support it, campaigns and things like that. It's hard to talk about this issue without talking about race. What is the role of kind of attempts to suppress votes by racial minorities in all of this?
I mean, unfortunately, it's really center stage that so much of vote suppression, you know, really throughout our history, but including in recent decades, has targeted communities of color. Whether that is because of what we would say in the sort of, you know, outright intentional racism, or because of their perceived or actual political affiliations. And I think, you know, in that respect, right, the Supreme Court has made things difficult because it has tried to draw distinctions from time to time between efforts to target communities of color because of, you know, quote unquote, racism versus targeting them because it's a proxy for partisanship. And the court has sort of at times said, you know, the former is out of bounds, but the latter is just politics. But of course, these things are actually very difficult to separate. And a lot of times what you will actually see is you will see, you know, political officials who have engaged in some of this context say, well, no, I'm not racist. I just, you know, I don't want Democrats to vote, or I don't want someone else to vote. But those lines are obviously not nearly as clear as some people say they are.
To be explicit on that, it's because in recent decades, Black people in particular have skewed Democratic and other groups not so much.
Absolutely. Although, and you know, to the other extent, it's not only seeing Black Americans being targeted. It's also Latino Americans. Increasingly now, Asian Americans are targets for voter suppression. So it is a really broad problem. And again, it is often sort of masked in this guise of, well, we're just, you know, playing hardball politics.
Yeah. So let me ask you, following up to Kimberly's points, let me ask an intentionally naive question, right? Especially because in the past year or really 8 or 9 months, it's been clear that Republicans are doing this, are working to limit and restrict voting access and access to the ballot box for partisan gain, right? To use the Supreme Court's phrasing, right? But do we know historically who gains politically and who benefits by restricting access to the ballot box?
For the past, you know, really 50 years, there has often been this assumption that Republicans and conservatives more broadly sort of are the ones that win when fewer people vote. And you know, starting in the early 1980s, again, they kind of elements of the conservative movement kind of explicitly started to associate the idea that, you know, preventing some people from voting would be a way to help them win. Certainly today, it's not actually clear that that's the case. You know, the 2020 election was an incredibly high turnout election, and many people would say that Republicans actually exceeded expectations. They did very well down ballot, and the presidential race was closer than it was expected. So, you know, empirically, I don't know that you can actually say that it's true that Republicans or conservatives benefit from lower turnout. But there is a perception that they do. And again, it is unfortunate that this perception does drive, you know, many of the sort of voter suppression efforts that we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm. So Attorney General Merrick Garland announced last week that the Department of Justice is going to take steps to secure the vote. And, you know, if you got some time, I would recommend that everybody actually read that speech. It's quite something. But how much can the federal government actually do to stop the state level laws that are restricting the right to or restricting access to vote?
The federal government has some power. Under the Voting Rights Act, which was this landmark bill that was passed in the late 1960s, the federal government can sue to overturn discriminatory state voting laws. But they have less power than some might assume, in part because the most significant portion of the Voting Rights Act, which had actually required that jurisdictions with a history of voting discrimination actually get their voting laws pre-cleared or pre-approved by the federal government, that was struck down by the Supreme Court in 2013. And that was really the most potent tool the Department of Justice had to prevent discriminatory voting laws. And then, of course, also, you know, the Voting Rights Act is focused, rightly so, on race, because that was, you know, kind of the defining issue when it was passed. But voter suppression doesn't just target groups based on their race. They also, for instance, you know, there's a long history of targeting young people for voter suppression. And the federal government has significantly less power to deal with that. So, you know, it's not that the Justice Department is powerless. And in fact, again, they introduced the Attorney General announced some very powerful moves that they're going to take. But there's only so much they can do under current law.
Well, so let's get to current law and possible solutions, right? Because for all his positive intent, right? Merrick Garland can only do so much, as you say. It's clear that the big voting rights bill on the Hill that Democrats want is not going to pass because of the Senate and filibuster and all of that stuff, and people have heard that news. There is the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which has a slightly better chance. What happens, I guess, is the really downer question. What happens if Congress can't get its act together and figure out what to do about this?
Well, you know, Kai, I'm going to disagree that I think that it's not yet clear, absolutely, they can't pass. I agree that there are political hurdles, but I want to say that they really need to get their act together. You know, what is scary to me is this normalization of the idea that you can manipulate voting rules for partisan advantage, that's kind of a legitimate tactic. And the single most powerful thing that can be done in response to that, which is what the For the People Act, S1, HR1 does, is it sets this basic standard, minimum standard for access to the ballot box that it would apply nationwide. And I think it's absolutely critical that the federal government do that. And you know, Senator Manchin, I guess I'll give you a reason why I'm not completely down in the dumps. All about right. This is Senator Manchin himself,
down in the dumps, just a little bit.
I want to say there's a glimmer of hope. Like, look, I'm not going to mislead your listeners, but I think that Senator Manchin himself, who is, of course, the Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, is the kind of the deciding vote on a lot of this, has said, you know, we have to deal with this problem. This is not something that can wait. This is an urgent priority. The question is there any sort of bipartisan consensus that can be forged around this? It doesn't seem likely. But everyone who has the power to do something agrees that something needs to be done. And the question is, what is that? And will they feel the sense of urgency? And I really, obviously, you know, it's my view that they really do need to get this done, and that they need to get it done. You know, restoring the full power of the Voting Rights Act is critical, restoring that preclearance process, but that there also needs to be this basic standard for voting access that applies nationwide for federal elections. And that's really critical, and that needs to be part of the equation.
And, you know, to sort of glom on to that glimmer of hope, one of the reasons that money is coming into this from both sides is there's been incredible organizing to fight against these laws, and a lot of money going into that and big names going into it. A lot of the same coalitions we saw trying to drive voter turnout in the 2020 election are now turning to this issue. And then you see some state lawmakers also kind of digging in on this, like in Texas, where they actually walked out to stop a voter suppression law from passing there, and seem to have gotten some gains as a result of that action.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was an important moment, an important move, and we'll see how that particular situation pans out in the end. But it certainly made a huge difference. I mean, I think that these issues are front and center in a way that they really haven't been since the era when the Voting Rights Act was passed. Like, people are aware that this is a critical, critical issue, and that for a variety, and I would say that's true on both sides of the aisle. And that, you know, in a fundamental level, what's at stake is the quality of our democracy. Whereas I think that there often had been before recent years this perception that voting rights and the whole panoply of democracy issues, gerrymandering, were kind of niche issues that nobody really cared about, that, you know, people would say that they cared, but they didn't really. I don't think that's true anymore. And you have some of the most powerful people really lined up saying, like, this needs to be a priority, from the Speaker of the House to Majority Leader Chuck Schumer to the President and the Vice President. So I think that, you know, there's tremendous power and pressure for action. And the question right now is, like, what is that going to be? But I do think that just sort of leaving it alone is not an option.
Okay. Thank you so much, Daniel Wiener. He's the deputy director of the Brennan Center, which is a nonpartisan group which monitors voting laws and many other things.
I have hope.
Yeah. I'm gonna land on team hope there.
Yep. Yep. Daniel, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
I guess the challenge in having hope is that you see the daily cluster bleepity bleep that is the current state of political discourse in this country. And you're like, come on. Are you kidding?
So one of the more inspiring stories that I actually got to do in the 2020 election was when I went home to St. Louis, and Missouri had passed this law that said if you want to vote absentee, you have to get your ballot notarized. And all of these people, Republicans and Democrats, independents, rushed to get certified as notaries and were setting up just all over the place, at farmers markets, at churches, would go to people's houses to allow everybody who wanted to vote absentee in a pandemic to do that. Just completely across the political spectrum engagement. Because fundamentally, they were all like, yeah, this is super important. People should be able to vote. Yeah. And if they're scared to go out in a pandemic, I am going to take the personal responsibility to make that happen. And so I do think that that spirit is there in the country. So yeah, I'm gonna go on Team Hope.
There you go. And we're going to go to break on that. Send us your comments on anything you heard on today's show or anything you hear on any show, frankly. Email, voice memo, take your pick. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
Okay, time for the news fix. Kai, you go first.
Time for the news. I'm going to log one for the inflation is transitory camp here. That is, of course, the big debate in macroeconomics right now. Jay Powell and the Fed. Is that a slow clap? Is that what I heard? Is that
a slow clap?
Are you slow clapping me? You're slow clapping me. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Oh,
man. So, look. Here's the deal. I know people are sick and tired of hearing about inflation, but it could be real. But here is an indicator that maybe it won't be. We've all been hearing about lumber prices up to a record like $1,700 per like zillion board feet or whatever the measurement is in May, 10th of May, $1,700. Today, like $900 and something. Lumber's coming down in a big, bad hurry. And I'm just going to say Jay Powell is looking at that saying two things. Number one, I was right. And number two, phew. So we'll see. I mean, look, there's a long way to go between now and knowing what's going to happen with inflation, but this is a transitory sign.
You and I both talk to a lot of economists on a regular basis, and they can often be a little dry, but sometimes they get very, very excited about things. And I was speaking to one economist a couple of days ago for a story, and I was talking to him about inflation, and he very vehemently was saying, the only people worried about inflation are the rich people who are worried about their stock market portfolios going down. Everyone else is fine. And there really is this sort of skewed narrative about inflation. Like, yes, some elements of inflation are in your face, gas prices, some food prices, lumber and things like that. But there is a lot of indication that those things are transitory or temporary. And really, it does seem that the loudest complaints about inflation are the people who are very, very comfortable at the moment.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. Totally true. So we shall see. We shall see. But I think that's an interesting data point for today.
Yes. So I have, you know, three links in the little prep doc, but it's all the same story, which is about this Alzheimer's drug that got approved by the FDA. And I've been just sort of sitting on the story that I read in The Atlantic since, I guess, what was like 4 or 5 days ago, where I'm scrolling, the drug that could break American healthcare is the headline on it.
Yep.
Because this new Alzheimer's drug is Biogen, which coincidentally happens to be one of the companies that helped come up with the COVID vaccines, it wants $56,000 for this treatment, right? And it would additionally cause people to have a lot more PET scans and other expensive things to remain eligible for the treatment. It's such a terrible disease, and having hope that something could really help is really encouraging. But what a lot of the people in the medical community are saying is one of two things. One, either there wasn't enough evidence that this drug was effective, and two, oh my gosh, that's way too expensive. Like, even some of the big associations that were supporting the drug's passage were just like, where did this number come from? And it's causing a huge backlash. A bunch of people have like sort of quit the FDA panel that approved it. And now the FDA is saying that they want to send it back and get more testing. But it's still kind of going ahead. Now, here's why this is particularly interesting from an economic perspective. This is a disease that primarily affects older Americans, right? Older Americans who tend to be on Medicare, which is our federally funded healthcare system, which means for all intents and purposes, a huge portion of this cost of this drug for the people who use it and the test that they need to keep remaining eligible for it is going to be borne by American taxpayers. And so, and not just the federal government, but also Medicaid on the state level, because they have to pay into these systems as well. And you very quickly see how something that gives so much hope to people who are suffering from this disease or their families who are taking care of them really has a potential to cause a bit of a healthcare catastrophe. And it just is the latest example of how complicated and weird the American healthcare system is. But
so,
it's
so weird. I think the tell on this one was when those three people resigned from the advisory panel to the FDA. That was like, oh, something is not right here. Yeah. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
That was a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, yeah. Something new is coming out about it almost every day, and I've been just gobbling it up every single time I see this because it really just touches on so many different things, because the pharmaceutical industry, which was just sort of hated pre-pandemic, but has, you know, gotten some of its shine back for just the amazing science that brought us these vaccines in such a short period of time. And it's like, is this really how you want to spend your goodwill?
Yep. Yep. All right. That's for the news. Let us do the mailbag, shall we?
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Excellent. We will do all of those things. Did a show last week on the rise of ransomware and cyber attacks and that whole thing that's going on. Got an email from Sarah in Washington, D.C. Here's what she says. I think one idea is missing. What about making the act of paying a ransom illegal? I mean, really illegal. For example, you personally will go to jail if you are a chief financial officer who approves your company making such a payment. And insurance companies would not be permitted to sell insurance policies that covered ransomware. Well, so, Sarah, fascinating. Two thoughts. Number one is, do we want the government that far into the economy? Yes, the government's going more into the economy, but that's an interesting proposition. Number two, let's say this. Let's say Facebook gets ransomware, right? And all of their data for all 2 billion people on the planet gets locked up. And they say, we want 14 billion Bitcoin to let this go. And it's against the law for Mark Zuckerberg to pay the ransom. Think about all the small businesses that operate on Facebook, just for one thing, and what happens to them. I appreciate the creativity. I don't know that it's realistic. That's my thought.
And to just continue on with your example, what about all the people whose personal information would then be for sale on the dark web? And that
better
could
point.
Be a
better point, for sure. Yep.
Because it reminds me of all the laws internationally about don't pay kidnappers ransoms, but people still do it because they don't want, you know, friends, families, or employees to die or be harmed. There's only so far such rules can go. Okay, that's now right. We have voice memo from Anne in Florida.
I am a physician, a veteran, an artist, a glassblower, and even completed an Ironman triathlon a few years ago. But nothing I have ever done has ever impressed my teenager until he found the Discord app on my phone that I downloaded so that I could participate in your Friday live feed Economics on Tap. So I want to thank you for making me appear at least remotely cool in the eyes of my 15-year-old. And I would like to know if you have any other suggestions for similar tech unsavvy moms like me. Thanks.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That's great. I love that. I'm a dad, and I got the dad bod and the dad joke, so I'm not the guy. But man, holy cow!
My niece is getting ready to come and stay with me in a couple of weeks, and I'm sure I will be reminded of all of the ways in which I am no longer cool once she's here. So I'm
totally.
I will be looking to the Discord community to probably get me up to date on things.
It's a good one. One more voice memo. Here comes Nathan in San Diego.
I wanted to get your opinion on 980 work schedules. I just started an internship at Northrop Grumman, and I really enjoy having every other Friday off. With all the discussion on how the pandemic is changing work, I think alternative schedules should be adopted by more companies. On the flip side, if Marketplace was to take this up, we'd be missing out on games with Drew Jostedt every other week. Slightly half empty on that.
So 980 would be you work 9 days a week, but you still do 80 hours of work. Is that the deal?
No, I had to look this up in preparation for this because I didn't know what it was either. So basically over 2 weeks, so you have 5 work days each week. Over those 2 weeks, you have to work 80 hours. And it typically gets divvied up that you're doing like 9 days every 2 weeks. And so however you work out those hours, you end up with 1 day off, but you still get the 80 hours in 2 weeks.
That's cool.
So
I'd be down with that.
I think it works. for some companies. I mean, look, we're in the news business. We work when there is news.
I was just going to say. The challenge is that the show goes on the air every day, whether it's 980 or, you know, 24/7 or whatever, right? So, yeah.
But in a lot of other industries, exactly. Look, this is just a discussion that's happening. People are going to have to figure out what works for them and for their individual industries. I doubt there's going to be a universal answer. But I think one thing coming out of the pandemic is that everybody wants a better work-life balance.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's exactly right. And there's a zillion stories to be done in that field. Okay. As we always do, the answer to the Make Me Smart question is coming up next. What is something you thought you knew, you later found out you were wrong about? Today's answer comes to us from Jeff Mangiancalda. He is the CEO of Coursera, which is the big online learning platform that Molly had on tech. I guess it was Amy, actually.
It was
Molly
Amy, yeah.
Amy had Jeff on Marketplace Tech not too long ago. Anyway, here he is, Jeff Mangiancalda, the CEO of Coursera.
I was convinced that the most efficient and effective way for a company to perform at a high level is for us to all go to the office 5 days a week.
Here you go.
Remote work is not the best in every dimension, but we at our company, at least, have been extraordinarily productive. And when you really think about the possibility to blend certain types of work activities that you could do at home on your own, on your computer, with other types of work activity, which maybe you do want to be more collaborative and you want to be more social and you go into the office. I now believe that the optimum is not 5 days a week in the office. It's probably two or so. Oh. And for many jobs and many people, especially when you can get to the full talent pool out there who lives away from the office, even not coming into an office at all is probably worth it if it means you can pick up the best talent in the country.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, look, I think there are a lot of changes coming. I think people are, it's that shift from you know, power being with management to power being with the workers and labor. It's really interesting.
I don't know. I think that really that whole thing may be a bit overstated, but I'm in a
Do you really?
I do. Because
wow. All right. Well, let me just super quick tell people what we're talking about. Neil Irwin in the New York Times, Barry Ritholtz on his blog have pointed out some of the indicators that they believe that the power dynamic in the American economy is switching from capital and management to labor now as people start to value things outside the work. And I think it has some merit. Kimberly doesn't. I guess we'll take it up at another time.
I think it has merit. I just think it may be a bit overstated. But yeah, maybe that's another deep dive conversation for later.
Yeah, that's another conversation for sure.
I'm going to take your part, Kai, and say don't forget to send us your answers to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew you later found out you were wrong about? And, you know, I'm okay ending that sentence with a preposition, but sorry, Mrs. Reader from sixth grade. You can reach us at makemesmart@marketplace.org with a voice memo, preferably. Sorry. My neurosis.
That is something I will not put. Yeah.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Oh, my God. All right. Juan Carlos, take us out of here.
Yeah.
Help us.
Make
save
Me
us
Smart
from ourselves.
Is produced. Wait, I started too early. Okay. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and smart speaker skills. And Grace Rubin is our new intern.
Grace. Today's program was engineered by Juan Carlos Tirado. Liana Scolacci is going to mix it later on. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Senior producer is Donna Tam. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. And there you go. Another Tuesday in the books. Take the afternoon off.
I've had so many conversations with Rick Carr on the deadlines for story about whether or not I will end a sentence with a preposition. Just like, let it go, Kimberly. Just let it go.
Just leave it be. Leave it be.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.